Hey Northview, this is the last weekend in our summer spectacular of speakers, and I'm so looking forward to being back with you next weekend. But in some ways, I've saved the best for the last. Today, you get the opportunity to hear Cal Jernigan speak. Cal is a great guy and a great friend. He serves as the senior pastor of Central Christian Church of the East Valley. Central Christian is centered in Mesa, Arizona and the surrounding area, and have over 10,000 folks meeting in 5 different campuses. Cal refers to himself as an accidental megachurch pastor. He served 18 years in youth ministry before moving into his role as senior pastor. I know you're going to like this guy. Would you give Cal a warm Northview welcome?
All right. Hey, greetings, Northview. Man, I got to tell you, I am so honored to be here. I am thrilled that I got asked, and I got to clarify why I am anchoring this summer series, okay? It's not what you think. See, the reason I am the last guy is because when I get done today, you will be so anxious to have Steve back next week. You can't wait until he gets back when you hear me, and that's why I'm here today. Okay. Hey, I want to tell you something about your church, man, and about your senior pastor. Number one, I love Steve. I haven't known him but for a couple of years, and just getting to know him, man, I just feel like, man, I think we might have been born by the same mother or something. I don't know. I just resonate with that guy, and I hope that when I die that we both end up on the same cul-de-sac, you know what I'm saying, in heaven, and we get to do barbecues together, because I just think you guys are so incredibly blessed. And I want you to know something. There are a whole lot of churches that would love to have your senior pastor, and you are very, very blessed, and I just hope you know that, all right? Okay, cool. Also, I want to let you know that you guys are being talked about. Did you know how quiet it got? You guys are being talked about, but in all kinds of good ways. I mean, people are noticing what's going on here, and a lot of people are like turning their heads going like, what's happening here? And you're getting known in some really cool ways. In fact, I got on an airplane Friday to come from Phoenix to here and ended up talking to the guy next to me on the plane, and he was from Indianapolis, and as we were talking, he asked me who I was and what I was doing. I told him that I was going to come here, and he is a Catholic man, and he goes, I know of that church. He's talking about you guys. And he started telling me of these ministries that you guys are all involved in. And I think, how incredibly cool is that? That you just get in a random conversation with somebody. And so I just want you to understand that what's happening here, a lot of people are drawing their attention towards you. So that's really, really cool. Now, I wish what was happening here was happening everywhere in the United States. I wish every church was experiencing what you're experiencing. But what I want to do for the next few moments is I want to be negative. Now, just hang on, okay? Just for the few moments, I want to put some things in perspective. And the reason I want to do this is because if you don't understand what I'm about to tell you, you will never appreciate this. So allow me for just a moment to go dark, okay? Here's the reality. In America, there's somewhere between 300 and 400,000 churches. We don't actually know the number because a lot of churches meet in homes and they don't identify and they don't, you know, report anything. And so somewhere between 300 and 400,000, but here's what we know. Every year, about 3,000 of them go out of business. Well, what do you mean a church going out of? A church goes out of business when it locks its doors, puts a for sale sign in front of the building, and has nobody showing up anymore. And churches are dying off at about that rate. And in fact, as they've studied the church in America, they've discovered some unsettling things. Like they figured out that about 85% of churches are plateaued or are declining in America. We're kind of going backwards here. That only 15% of churches could be called effective. Maybe only 10% could be called highly effective. You would fit that category. But what it leaves is a whole bunch of churches that are not doing a whole lot. In fact, 1/3 of all the churches in America, they've concluded, those who have studied churches said that 1/3 are just desperately hanging on. They're near dead. They're dying. And in fact, of all the churches in America, 1/2 last year did not have a single person, not one person, come to faith in Jesus Christ in that church. And in all of America, if you talk about like who are the evangelical Christians really in America, and a lot of people say they're Christian, but who are the, you know, honestly, if you drill down, who are the evangelical Christians that believe in the truth of Scripture and whatnot? It's only 7 to 9% of Americans right now. All right, and they're estimating that 3 decades out, because of the rate of growth, of population growth, that there's only going to be about 4% of the United States that will be evangelical Christian 3 decades from now. Okay, let me put a couple more things. You think that's as bad as it gets? No, it gets a little bit worse. For us, what's so scary is that young people are starting to disassociate from the church in record numbers. And in fact, Barna says that 4 out of 5 people who are under 30 will separate from the church by the time they turn 30. You go, that just can't get any worse. Thanks for coming all the way from Arizona to tell us this bad news. Folks, it gets worse. Okay? A couple more thoughts. At the rate Islam is growing in the world, it's projected that by the year 2050, it's going to surpass Christianity in terms of numbers. And if you don't understand what that means, imagine the future where America is referred to as an Islamic nation. Now, why am I telling you all that? I mean, my goodness, I came to church to be uplifted, not to be, because see, this is the deal. If you think this is normal, you don't understand. And see, so if I'm going to come here and tell you how important you are, you've got to understand the light you are to the rest of the world. You got to understand that people don't get this. This is not the experience most people have when they go to church. This is different. And most people, when they picture church, do not picture this. And so what I want to wrestle with you, in these moments is, how are you doing with the passion for Christ these days? Because I'm telling you, people are watching you, and you're going to set the pace. So how's it going? Let me remind you of what Jesus said as far as why we do all this. And by the way, just so we're really clear, this thing right here, this thing called the church, this is the only thing Jesus founded. There are so many good causes, and there's so many things to give your money to and your heart to and your energy and your passion to. This is the only thing Jesus started right here, this thing. And when he started it, he gave us a mission, and the mission was very, very clear. And I know you know this, but let me just remind you of what he said. And this is from Matthew chapter 28. He said, "Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." You see, the big ask of Jesus to us was replicate yourself. Replicate yourself. And in fact, this thing that Jesus founded, this thing called the church, he said, and I believe with all my heart, he said the gates of hell cannot prevail against the church. The church is going to accomplish what God. Churches like yours will get it done. But here's the deal. Sometimes we forget that we're the only organization in the world that exists for the sake of those who don't yet belong. Let me say that again. We're the only organization on the planet that exists not for our sake, but for the sake of those who don't yet belong. Rick Warren says every church needs to ask itself two questions. What business are we in, and how's business? So let me ask you a simple question. With all this cool stuff going on here at Northview, how excited are you these days about it? How amped up are you? How hot is the passion level in you these days? In 1997 in Chicago, there was a speech given by a CEO of a very prominent company, and it was given to the Executives Club in Chicago. And the guy that gave the speech was the CEO of Coca-Cola. His name was Roberto Goizueta. And he said something so profound in this speech. Let me just quote a little snippet of what he said, okay? He said, "A billion hours ago, human life appeared on Earth. A billion minutes ago, Christianity emerged. A billion seconds ago, the Beatles performed on the Ed Sullivan Show. A billion Coca-Colas ago was yesterday morning. And the question all of us are asking us around Coke today is, what do we have to do to get a billion Coca-Colas ago to not be yesterday morning, but to be this morning?" And then he said these words, "At the end of every day of every year, two things remain unshakable: our constancy of purpose and our continuous discontent with the immediate present." Let me ask you a question. Hands up. How many of you like Coke? You like Coke? I like Coke. I love Coke. I love Coke, but you know what? I would never give my life to it. You know why? It's sugared water. I just could not get that excited, and the guy died 2 months after he gave that speech. I would not give my life and live for Coca-Cola, but there's living water that I would give my life for, and I get all amped up, and I get all energetic about, and it would matter to me. You see, the truth of the matter is folks, that when you have something worth living for, you have something worth dying for. And when you have something worth dying for, you have something worth living for. And I'm telling you, you got to understand what's going on here. You see, you don't think about this, but you understand your church is being threatened right now in ways you maybe don't even think about. So let me just challenge you to think about it. Number one, you're being threatened by Satan. What are you talking about? Oh, I promise you, Satan is paying attention to you all. I promise you, Satan is trying to take you down. And I give you my word, Steve is under attack, okay? And your leaders are under attack. Your elders, your staff, you who are serious about your walk, you're under attack. Because see, every other church that's in this area that's not doing anything, Satan's fine with them. In fact, most people, now listen carefully, this is important. Most people have no idea this stuff happens in church these days. When people think of church, they don't think of this. This is not the experience they're imagining. Go back in your mind to church when you were a kid. One word, starts with a B, right? Can I get an amen? They don't picture this. They picture being forced to go. So what happens is to all the other churches that aren't seriously doing anything, see, somebody will visit those churches and they'll go, yeah, just like I remember when I was a kid, nothing's changed, not interested, and Satan goes, good. You see, there are churches that serve the purposes of Satan, but not this one. But because, see, you are a secret he wants to keep under wraps. He doesn't want people to know. He doesn't want people to find out what's going on here. When I was baptized, and by the way, I was sitting down there this morning, I figured this out. I was baptized 41 years ago today. To the day. No, yeah. Woo! I don't know why, but woo! Anyway, but I want to tell you what happened when I got baptized, because I'm really, I mean, I go down, my senior pastor from my church baptized me, and I'm baptizing me, and I come out of the water, and he said something so freaked me out. I still to this day, he damaged me, my psyche. It's all screwed up, man. But this is what he said. He goes, Kyle, I want to warn you right now. I mean, what is this? You're supposed to be congratulations. No, I want to warn you. And this is what he said. He goes, if you're serious, I want you to understand something. Right now, you have a target on your chest, and Satan is going to take aim at you. And every imp in hell, that's what he said, every imp in hell? I didn't even know what that meant. Every imp in hell is going to be targeting you now. And I'm like, why? And he's what he said. What did I do? He goes, look, if you're serious, then your life will never be the same again. And every life you come in contact will never be the same again. And Satan knows that. So if you're serious about this commitment, you better be ready because you're going to be targeted. Okay, I don't know about the theology of that, but I want to tell you that. If that's true, what about a church like this? You see, Satan needs to keep you under wraps. And he's got to do everything he can do to pull you down. So you be ready for that. But there's a second threat. It's even more insidious. It's not because Satan did it. It's something we do. And you know what it is we do? We drift. That's the second threat to your church. You drift. What do you mean? You see, this church was all about this when it was founded. It was all about this. This is what this church is about. But see, what happens is this starts to morph over to that. This is why we started, but that is what we've become. Every church, our church, your church, every church has this threat to drift over from this to that. And pretty soon everyone's thinking about that and people forgot about this. And that takes over. It's human nature. We all do this. So we have an expression. I'll start it, you finish it. The main thing is to keep the main thing. How do you know that? Because we've repeated it so many times because we drift. We just forget why we started. We were about this when we started, but we became about that. So what I want to do right now is I want to read you something that I read to my church every single year. This is absolutely the most often repeated illustration in our church. The longer you've been in our church, the more you will know this, and we got people who know this illustration cold. Now what I want to do is, it's a parable, and I don't want to tell it to you, I want to read it to you. So if you'll indulge me and just allow me to do that. And what I want you to do is understand that, number one, it's a parable, it didn't come out of the Bible. I did write it, I don't know who did write it, so I can't credit it, but it wasn't me. But here's what I want you to do, is I want you to imagine this, and if I knew you really, really well, I would say, close your eyes. Just imagine this, but I don't know you really well, and some of you would fall asleep. And I'd see you out there sleeping, and that'd hurt my feelings, so I'm not gonna let you do that. Okay, so let me just read this to you, though, and you just imagine, eyes wide open, okay? Imagine this story. This is how it goes. On a dangerous seacoast where shipwrecks often occur, there was once a crude little life-saving station. The building was just a hut, and there was only one boat, but the few devoted members kept a constant watch over the sea, and with no thought for themselves, went out day and night tirelessly searching for the lost. Many lives were saved by this wonderful little life-saving station, so it grew and grew, and it became quite famous. Now, some of those who were saved and various others in the surrounding area wanted to become associated with the station and give of their time and their money and their effort for the support of its work. New boats were bought and new life-saving crews were trained, and thus a little life-saving grew and grew more. Some of the members of the life-saving station were unhappy that the building was so crude and so poorly equipped. And they felt that a more comfortable place should be provided as the first refuge for those saved from the sea. So they replaced the emergency cots and beds and put better furniture in the now newly enlarged building. Well, now the life-saving station became a popular gathering place for its members, and they decorated it beautifully, and they furnished it exquisitely because they used it as sort of a club. It became a clubhouse. Fewer members were now interested in going to sea on life-saving missions, so they hired lifeboat crews to do this work. Yet the life-saving motif still prevailed in the club's decorations, and there was a liturgical lifeboat in the room where the club held its initiations. Well, about this time, there was a large ship wrecked off the coast, and the hired crews brought in loads of cold, wet, half-drowned people. They were dirty and sick, and many of them didn't look like the other members of the club. The beautiful new clubhouse was considerably messed up. Immediately, the property committee made a decision to have a shower house built outside the club where the victims of shipwreck could be cleaned up before being invited inside. Well, at the next meeting, there was a split in the club's membership. Most of the members wanted to stop the club's life-saving activities as being unpleasant and a hindrance to the normal social life of the club. Other members, however, insisted on life-saving as their primary purpose, and they pointed out they were still called a life-saving station. But they were finally voted down and told that if they wanted to save the lives of various kinds of people who were shipwrecked in those waters, they could begin their own little life-saving station down the coast a bit, which they did. As the years went by, the new station experienced the same changes that had occurred in the old one. It evolved into a club, and yet another life-saving station was founded. History continued to repeat itself, and if you were to visit that coast today, you would find a number of exclusive clubs all up and down the coast. And then this last line, and it's chilling. Shipwrecks are frequent in those waters, but most of the people drown. Folks, I just don't know any better picture of what happens to a church like this. That is so clearly accomplishing what you were, it's called drift. And you go, it'll never happen to us. But folks, it's human nature. You have to fight this. And in fact, if you know the history of the United States, a lot of our organizations that were founded for Christian purposes. People don't know this, but a lot of our universities, the majority of our universities were founded for Christian purposes. In fact, let me do something. Let me read, I've got right here in front of me. I have got the original mission statement of Harvard University. Harvard University was founded in 1636. Let me read to you why they founded Harvard. Ready? Here we go. Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is, ready, to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. That's why it was founded. When is the last time you've associated Christianity with Harvard? That's drift. You go, yeah, but that's just a unique. No. It happens to universities. It happens to organizations, okay? Like if I say the YMCA, what does YMCA stand for? Who knows? Young Men's Christian Association. You see, when you go around calling it Young Men's Christian Association, pretty soon you go, you know, that's just kind of, that's cumbersome. Let's just, we shorten it. So instead of calling it Young Men's Christian, we started calling it YMCA. It's the YMCA. And then the YMCA, like, that's just too long. So now we call it the Y. Now stop and just put all that together. It's the Y. And people don't associate the Y with the original reason why the Y was founded. And in fact, today when most people think of the YMCA, they think of a song, the Village People, right? Like, what happened here? Yes, you've got the motions. I got it. It's called drift, and it's very, very real. Now, understand this. Jesus said his church will prevail. Some churches will. I hope yours will. But what I want to do in the next few minutes, I don't have much time. I want to fire off three things that'll keep you focused. Three things, and again, I talk to my church about this all the time. Three things to just never, ever forget. And so if you'll indulge me, let me just find. Now, these are not like profound. You're not going to go, wow, that guy from Arizona, that was so deep. That's not what's going to happen. You're just going to go, that's important. Here's number one. Don't ever forget who you are. Just write that down if you would. Don't ever forget who you are. What do you mean? Don't ever forget who you are. Your identity is crucial. If I say the name Kirk Douglas, how many of you know who I'm talking about? Kirk Douglas. If I say Michael Douglas, how many can pick up some? Michael Douglas, son of Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas. And for those of you who have no idea, I'm sorry. You're just so good to be young. Kirk Douglas was an icon of Hollywood, and he was famous for lots of reasons. But one of the things that most people discovered about him is he loved to pick up hitchhikers and give them rides. And he tells us one story I've never forgotten this story. What happened was there was a guy that was exiting the Navy in San Diego, and he was thumbing a ride up the coast, headed back, I think, to Seattle. And Kirk was driving the Malibu Highway, which is PCH1, the highway that runs along the coast, and he saw this guy thumbing a ride. And so he pulled over and offered him a ride. And he asked where he was going. He said, "Hop in, I'll give you a ride." And so the guy threw his duffel bag in the back of Kirk Douglas's car, and then he jumped in and he kind of looked at the driver. And he had one of those, you know, kind of those moments of recognition. He looked at the guy and he goes, "Man, I know this guy. Who is this guy?" And the way Kirk described it, he turned his head away and he was racking his brain. And then he kind of glanced over. They did one of those. And he could just see his wheels returning. He's trying to figure out who I am. And he looks, he steals another look, you know, a little bit longer. And he's getting frustrated. He's like, "I know this guy." And all of a sudden, he said he figured it out. He saw him figure it out because he just lit up. He goes, "Whoa, do you have any idea who you are?" That's a great question. Do you have any idea who you are? I'm going to be candidly vulnerable with you guys here. I'm going to tell you one of my biggest issues as a senior pastor, and it's probably not what you think. One of my biggest issues is I am recognitionally challenged. And let me explain what that means. It means when, most people walk up and they recognize each other and they, you know, "I'll never forget your face." I don't have any of that. I'm like missing a chip, okay? I'm really slow. And so people will come up and talk to me and I just really have no idea who I'm talking to. It's pathetic. And being a pastor of a large church is really bad, okay? But God's gifted me with a saintly lady, my wife, Lisa, who is every bit as good as I am bad. And so she recognizes people really, really quickly. She's really good at this. And she's learned how to tell me who we're talking to, okay, in code, right? And the code is she'll say their name, all right? So somebody come, "Hey, Tom, how are you?" And I go, "Okay, the guy's name's Tom." And then we'll talk, and then I'll realize, oh, this is the chairman of the elders of our church. You know, it's pretty bad, okay? I'm just telling you. It's pretty pathetic. Sometimes Lisa will come up and go, "Remember me, I'm your wife." That helps, you know. Anyway, so being recognitionally challenged, though, what happens is that often my wife will tell me who somebody is, but they don't look like that person to me, and so I'll disagree with her. Because it doesn't look like them. And she'll go, "Yes, it is." And I'll go, "No, it's not." "Yes, it is." "No, it's not." And we'll go back and forth. Well, real life, this really happened. So a number of years ago, we were checking out at a Target in Mesa, and I got the elbow from my wife. And she said, two registers over, look. And I look over, and she goes, "You know who that is?" I'm recognitionally challenged. What's the answer? I got no idea. I go, "Nope." And you'll know this name. Most of you, I think. She goes, "That's Danny Ainge." Now, Danny Ainge played for Purdue and then played for the Celtics and then was then the coach of the Phoenix Suns. And I looked over and I go, "Seriously?" And I look over and I go, "No, it's not." Because that's what I do. I'm recognitionally challenged. I go, "No, it's not." She goes, "Yes, it is." And I go, "No, it's not." She goes, "It is. I'm telling you, that's Danny Ainge." I go, "If that was Danny Ainge, he'd be much taller." I go, "That is not Danny Ainge." Well, what I didn't know was my little 7-year-old girl, daughter, was listening to this. She had no idea who Danny Ainge was, but she knew how to solve the dilemma. Just go ask him. So as my wife and I are going, "Yes, no, not," she just walks over to him. And about the time she starts pulling on his shirt, I notice her. And I was like, oh, she tugging it on. And she says, "Hey, mister, I got a question for you." You know, Danny Ainge was so sweet. He looks down at him. He's this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid. "Are you Danny Ainge?" And he said the cutest thing. He says, "Well, that depends. Who's asking?" Isn't that cute? And she goes, "Well, my name's Amy, but that's not important. What's important is who are you? Are you Danny Ainge?" And she goes, he says, "Yes, honey, I'm Danny Ainge." And she looks up and she goes, "My daddy doesn't think so." to which Danny Ainge said to my little girl, "Who's your daddy?" "Him." I met Danny Ainge that day. It really was him. He's not as tall as you might imagine. Anyway, so let me tell you who you are, okay? Here's who you are, and it really matters that you know your identity. You know who you are? You are the bride of Christ. That's who you are. And it's really important that you get this. In fact, let me read to you what it says in the book of Ephesians. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. See, here's what's going to happen. If you forget who you are, you're going to do something unbecoming of the bride of Christ. You see, you are God's dearly beloved one. He's nuts about you. He's got your picture on his refrigerator, okay? He thinks about you all the time. You are deeply, deeply loved by God. That's who you are, the bride of Christ. Second thing you never want to forget is what you are. You don't ever want to forget what you are. You go, well, what are we? Let me just use the words of Bill Hybels. You are the hope of the world. That's who you are. You're the hope of the world. That's what you are, the hope of the world. You know, it's interesting. When you look at the world these days and you pay attention to what's going on, the world is messed up, yes? And it's getting worse all the time. I mean, all kinds of stuff going on internationally, but morally things are going, you know, crazy, and there's all kinds of diseases and issues, and it's just a messed up world. And the irony of this is that people use all the problems in the world to justify that there is no God. In other words, they say, if there was a God, all this stuff wouldn't be there. And then the second thought goes, well, God, if you're there, why don't you do something about all this? Why don't you do something? But you know, if we'd listen, and instead of yelling at God and actually listen, you know what God would say? I have done something. I put Northview there. I put Northview there to solve all of that. All of that stuff breaks my heart, so I put a bunch of my people there to fix that. You see, what you are, now listen, this is real important. What you are God's plan A, and he has no plan B. You're it. You are the solution. That's what you are. You're the hope of the world. And then the last one, and I think this is the most important one, so never forget who you are, never forget what you are. Most important one of all, never forget why you are. Never forget why you are. Have you ever thought about this? And maybe you never have, but let me just challenge you to think about this. Why doesn't God, when you figure out who he is, why doesn't God just rip you off this planet and get you out of the misery of this place and just immediately take you home? Why doesn't he just transfer you home? In other words, you figured out there was a God and you figured out Jesus was his son and he died for you and you gave your life for him. Ding, 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 you win. Come home, son. Why don't you just get to go to heaven? Why are you here? Well, that's an interesting question. You see, what a lot of us are trying to do is make the best of the misery of the planet we're living in. But often, now, this is real important. Stay with me. What we do is we go, yeah, well, the world is messed up, but man, my church is good. My church is good. And we look at our church and we go, yeah, it's the bright spot in the darkness of the world. Let me just challenge you to think this through. Stay with me. What is it about your church you love? Just think, okay? You might go, oh, man, that worship we just had. Folks, I'm telling you, your worship is awesome. That was really, really good. Man, it was awesome. I've been through everyone's church. It's awesome. You guys have great worship. But I got to break something to you. When you get to heaven and all the angels of heaven and all the other cultures and all the other music, they're going to bring instruments to heaven you've never even heard of. And all through time, all the believers are going to gather together. And as incredible as this worship was, when you get to heaven, this isn't going to sound like much. It's no knock on your worship. They're going to sound like a garage band, okay? Because you have all of heaven rejoicing. So why are we here? Why don't we get to go to heaven and experience that right now? You go, oh, Cal, you don't understand. You don't know our pastor. Pastor Poe is a man of God. And Pastor Poe, when he opens up the Bible, I feel like I am in the presence of God. And Pastor Poe makes God come alive when he preaches. I know that's true, but I want to tell you what's going to happen when you get to heaven. You're going to be in the presence of God. You're going to sit at the feet of God. And if Pastor Poe gets up and says, hey, let me tell you what my dad is like, God's going to go, hey, boy, sit down. I'll take this one. You know, you go, yeah, but we have such sweet fellowship. We have such a great time when we're together. Folks, all Christians throughout all time being together for eternity, as cool as it is. See, all your church is so hot. It's so good. But in the bigger picture, you're going to have a better time in heaven than you have here. Why are you still here? I'll tell you why you're still here. Because there's one thing you can do here that you can't do in heaven. Only one thing. Bring missing people home. You see, when God wraps this all up, all who didn't give their life to him will be excluded, and only those who have will be included. Why are you still here? Because God has a broken heart for those folks. The folks in your family, the folks that you work with, the folks on your street. In fact, let me read a couple of scriptures just so we put this in perspective, okay? Like 1 Timothy 2:3-4, this is good and pleases God our Savior. Look, who wants all men to be saved and come to a knowledge. You want to know what the will of God is? All men to be saved. That's the will of God. And then Peter is talking about, well, how come he hasn't returned yet? And he answers the question. Here is the answer. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. That's he's waiting for you to have that conversation with that person because he cares so much about that person. The mission of Jesus, as he described it in Luke 19:10, the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost. That is the mission. That's why you're here. Now, let me try to put something in perspective. How do you begin to grasp the sense of loss that the father feels when his children aren't going to come home? So let me try to put this in perspective. Just play along with me right here, okay? How many of you have ever lost your keys before? Raise your hand. If your hand is not up, you've lost your integrity, so go with the keys, okay? Everybody here has lost your keys. When you lose your keys, what happens to you inside? A little bit of a sense of panic, yeah. A little bit of anxiety, a little bit of, like, you go into search mode, right? And you start racking your brain, where did I leave them? You gotta find your keys. Okay, how many of you here have ever lost your wallet? Raise your hand, okay? Which would you rather lose, your keys or your wallet? I'd rather lose my keys. Why? Because your wallet is getting really close, right? It's got your identity, it's got your finances, it's got a lot. And you know, if I had to choose, I don't want to lose either, but it's just a car, but it is my identity. Okay, here's the third question. How many of you ever lost a wedding ring? And by this, I got to clarify, not you haven't lost it intentionally. Understand what I'm saying? Okay. How many of you ever lost a wedding ring? Which would you rather lose, a wedding ring or a wallet? Most people who are truly in love would go, oh, I'd rather lose my wallet. My wedding ring represents a relationship that I cherish, can't be replaced. Okay, now don't raise your hand here because this will get painful. How many of you ever lost a child? Don't raise your hand. Which would you rather lose, a wedding ring or a child? You see what I'm doing here? How do you explain the value of a child to a father, to a mother? Nothing compares. Nothing compares. And if you've ever lost, because you can lose a child by death or you can lose a child by wandering off. And they can be young or they can be old. It doesn't matter. They can wander. And when you sense you've lost a child, there is nothing you wouldn't give to get that child back. When my son was little, we were out on an Arizona lake and I had a little aluminum boat and we were fishing, we were hanging out, we were having a great time. And then all of a sudden the wind kicked up and the waves kicked up and they were crashing over this little boat. And I realized, man, this is dangerous. We got to get off this lake. We're on the other side. I tell my son, we got to hustle. And so we go as fast as this little motor will push and waves are crashing and water's coming in and it's just dicey. And we get to the other side, and I say to my son, son, can you just hold the boat right here? I got to get the truck and the trailer. And so I go up there. It wasn't a boat ramp. It was just one of those lakes that you just back into the lake, you know, on the rocks and all that, just down the shoreline. So he's holding the boat, and everything's good. I go get the trailer, go, you know, put it in, get out, try to get the boat around the trailer. And what's happening is the wind and the waves are coming this way, and it keeps pushing the boat this way, and I can't get it centered on the trailer to winch it in. And so I said to my son, I said, son, is there any way, it's just a little kid, is there any way you can just kind of push? And so he gets right up at the front of the boat, and he starts pushing at the front of the boat. And I go, no, son, you're going to have to go down a little ways. You know, the boat's turned sideways, so you're going to have to go down. We're going to have to push, and we're going to have to pull and get it on the ramp and on the bunks. And so I'll winch. And so I'm pulling from this side. He's pushing. What he's doing is he's got his hands on the gunwale. But see, at the beginning, I could see his head. But as he was working his way down. And pretty soon, I could just see his hands. I couldn't see his head. And I go, son, can you go a little farther? Because you look a little bit more. And all of a sudden, his hands disappeared. And I go, hey, Jerry, you okay? Hey, Jay, bud, you back there? Nothing. And all of a sudden, the boat just blows over. And I don't know how to tell you this other than if you've never experienced, but time freezes. It just goes, I mean, it stops. And I'm like, oh, no. And I go flying around that boat, and I am reaching, I'm shoving the boat. I don't care what happens to the boat. It doesn't matter. He matters. And I am reaching, and I'm trying hardest. And finally, I grab him. He's underneath. I pull him around. I pull him up. He comes up gasping for air. He's fully cognizant about what just happened. I'm fully, and I'll never forget what he said. He sucks up the air in his lungs. He goes, "Thanks, Dad." He knew he was dying. And I mean to tell you, this is what I did. I grabbed him. I just literally grabbed him. I walked to the back of my truck, and I just sat there, and I just held him. And I just, what almost just happened? Oh, my heart's pounding, his heart's pounding. It was an incredible moment. It's a memory. And after my heart stopped pounding, I kind of got my sense about me. I remember what I said to him. I said, "Son, this just needs to stay between us guys." Yeah. There ain't nothing good gonna come out of telling Mom about this, trust me. Yeah. So Jesus tells a story. He's got 100 sheep, one wanders off, he goes and looks for it. And see, the 99 are going, "It's a stupid sheep, it deserves to get eaten. Let it go." No. A woman drops, "Let it go." No. A father has two sons. How do you put into words? Okay, so I'm gonna close. I wanna tell you the story. It's a true story. This happened back about 7 years ago when my daughter was in college. She was 21, and I was speaking somewhere. I flew into Phoenix on a Friday night. My wife also has a ministry. She wasn't there, so my daughter came from her college. She had lived with roommates. She came over to the airport, picked me up, and drove me home 10:30 at night. I show up at my house, absolutely empty home, and my dog was there, and so my dog and I are having a reunion. We're kind of playing, and about 3 minutes after she drops me off, my cell phone rings, and my daughter is on the phone, and she says, "Dad, are you home?" What? I know you're home, but what I meant is, are you alone? Yep, just me and the dog. She goes, "Yeah, that's what I was talking about. I need you to come to the front door, and I need you to come alone." How many of you think this is a weird conversation? "What do you mean alone? I'm just me and the dog." She goes, "Yeah, you need to leave the dog behind." What? "Just meet me at the front door." I go to the front door, turn the light on, and she's standing there, and she's holding something. And I look at it, and I go, "What's that?" She goes, "Dad, I think it was hit by a car." I go, "What is it?" She goes, "It's a dog. I found it on the side of the road. I think it was hit by a car." And I look at this dog, and okay, now you're just going to have to follow. You're going to have to understand. You're going to have to cut me some slack. Number one, I was incredibly tired. Number two, I didn't want to be inconvenienced, and I really didn't feel compassion towards this dog. So I just confess all that ahead, all right? So she says, "I think it's hit by a car." And I looked at the dog. The dog was covered in mud and muck and dirty, and it was getting her all filthy, and it smelled really, really bad. And in all honesty, this was the ugliest dog I'd ever seen in my life. Just in all honesty, okay? Are we friends? Can I tell you the truth? Okay? It's an ugly dog. And I looked at that dog, and I looked it over, and I said, "Honey, that is not a dog that was hit by a car. That is a dog that was born looking like it was hit by a car. That's a messed up dog." And she goes, "Dad, what are we going to do with it?" Okay, anyone get a weird word in that? Did anyone pick up the word that was really weird in that sentence? There was a really weird word. What do you mean, "we"? There ain't no we with this dog. They know, what are we going to do with it? We ain't doing anything with this dog. And she says, "Well, Dad, what should I do with it?" I said, "I don't know. Go put it back and drive away and act like you never saw it. I don't know." She goes, "Dad, I can't do that." She couldn't do that. And then she says, "Can I keep it here tonight?" Anyone? Anyone know the answer to that question? Anyone? "No, honey, you can't keep that. I'm not messing with that dog. I'm too tired." She goes, "Okay. Well, I'm going to take it home then." I go, "All right." She goes, "Can I get some dog food and can I get some dog?" "Yep, go get it." So she gets it. I hold the dog. I'm now messy. She takes off. Well, her and her roommate show up at about 8 o'clock in the morning on the front porch with this dog. Did I tell you this dog was really, really ugly? Okay, now I'm going to describe this dog to you. Now you're going to have to, again, be gracious to me, all right? I'm a guest here. Don't email me. I'm going to tell you why this dog was so ugly. Okay, first off, there's nothing wrong with this brand of dog, all right? It was a pug dog. Okay, the pug dogs are not bad. Don't write me. Pug dogs are awesome. You do need to put a collar on so you know which ends you're looking at. But pug dogs are totally cool, I suppose, okay? It was a pug dog. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was not it was a pug dog. The problem was it was missing an eye. Yeah, it was a one-eyed pug dog. And not only that, that wasn't the worst of its problem. The other eye was covered with a cataract. It was probably a blind one-eyed pug dog. But they spent all night scrubbing this dog up, and they cleaned it up, and they got all that junk off of it, and it was running around the front porch, and it was really kind of a cool little dog. Ugly as sin, but it was really kind of a cool little dog. And so I said to my daughter, I said, that's awesome, you cleaned it up. What are you going to do now? She goes, well, I'm going to go down to the pound. I'm going to take it down the animal shelter and drop it off. I said, that's a great idea. So she gets on the car with her friends and go down I get a call from the pound. My daughter says, hey, Dad, I got bad news. Hey, what's up? She goes, I'm down at the pound and went to drop this dog off, and I found out that they don't take dogs on Saturday. Hey, guys, come here. Come here. No, seriously, lean in here. I'm pretty positive that it was that Saturday morning they set that policy. They saw that dog. Not on Saturday. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, honey. What are you going to do now? And she goes, well, they said we should go to PetSmart. You guys have PetSmart? Why are you going to go to PetSmart? Because they said sometimes people pay to put a chip in a dog and that PetSmart will be able to scan the dog. No chip in that dog. Honey, no one's going to pay to put a chip in that dog. My daughter gets real serious. She goes, Dad, you don't know that. Well, that's a fact, but... So she goes on to PetSmart. I get it. I'm not making any of this. I give you my honor. She calls him in PetSmart. She goes, Dad, hey, I got some bad news. And what's up? She goes, there's no chip in this dog. Duh. What are you going to do now? She says, well, people at PetSmart said we should walk it up and down the neighborhood where we found it. And that somebody will see it and claim it as their dog. So they put this poor little one-eyed pug dog on a leash and trolled it up and down our neighborhood for like 2 hours. Strangest thing happened. Not a single person claimed the dog. So they end up on my front porch 2 hours later. So now, I don't know, it's around noon or whatever it is. And I'm sitting there with her girlfriends and the dog. And I was like, honey, what are you going to do now? And she goes, I don't know. And I go, you can always go put it back. And no, we're not going to do that. And so she just got kind of this feisty, defiant thing in her. And she just goes, Dad, I'm going to go find the owner of this dog. And she's just real resolute. Just, I'm going to go find the owner of this dog. And so she gets the dog and her girlfriend, and they hop in the car, and off they go. Good luck. I get an hour later. Dad, you are never going to believe what I am looking at. What are you looking at? I am looking at a wanted poster of a one-eyed pug dog. It's our dog. And at this point, I'm going, what are the odds? It very well might be. And she said, there's a phone number, and I'm going to call it. And I said, honey, you be really, really careful when you call this guy, because anyone that would own a dog like that's a dangerous person. And so she goes, Dad, knock it off. So she calls, and she describes it, and apparently as she's describing it, the guy's going, I think that's our dog. I think that's our. He says, I'll come. Where are you? I'll come get it. She goes, no. We'll bring it to your house. And so on the way there, she calls me. When I said, Dad, I'm on my way over. We're going. And I go, seriously, you be careful. She goes, Dad, don't worry about it. So she pulls. This is what she described to me. She says she pulled up in front of the house, and there were three little blonde-headed girls, each in a little ascending order. And then there was a man standing there. And as soon as they pulled up, they opened the door, and the dog apparently could see, saw them, jumps out, runs over to them. And all of them in the front yard just got going crazy. This celebration breaks out. And they're going, Tally's home! Tally's home! The dog had a name! Go figure, short for Metallica. So Tally's home, and this whole party, and the guy starts sobbing. And my daughter is just watching this, and he goes, you have no idea how much this dog means to us. You have no idea what you've given us. And he says, my wife is on the road right now. I have got to call her and tell her it is Tally. And so he calls, and she starts bawling. This girl brought her home. He's home. And then the lady said, I got to talk to the girl. So the lady gets on the phone, and she goes, you have no idea. She goes, this dog has been in our family since before these three little girls were born. This is the only dog they've ever known. This dog means more to us than you can ever imagine. We lost this dog about 2 weeks ago. We have looked and searched everywhere. We have posted everything we know how to post. Last Wednesday night, we all got in our living room and we had a service to say goodbye to Tally because we were positive we'd never see our little precious Tally again, and you brought our dog home. And I don't have the words, but I told him, my husband is going to give you an incredible reward for what you've done. And my daughter said, not a chance. Not a chance. This right here is the greatest reward I could ever imagine for bringing your little dog home. And in just a moment, I'm going to go home and I'm going to see my dad. And that's going to be priceless, trust me. Yeah, and it was. Okay, let me close. You know, why did you just tell us that story? I want to explain something to you. I was a one-eyed pug dog. No, let me correct it. I am a one-eyed pug dog. I'm a cleaned up one-eyed pug dog. Now, I'm not that pug dog, but if you would have known me when I was in high school, you see, I was in a ditch on the side of the road. I smelled really bad. I was covered in muck. I was blind as I could be, and I was as undesirable, and you would have every reason in the world to walk past me. But I stand here today because somebody that the Father sent said, I got to get that one cleaned up and bring him home. And they brought me home. And so I stand here. See, I told you a story about my son drowning, but there was a day before that I was the boy drowning. I was dying. I just needed somebody to reach under and pull me up. And I'm here today because somebody did, because the Father sent somebody to pull me up. Yeah, I told you about sheep wandering off. Folks, I was the sheep that wandered off. Yeah, some of you understand what I'm talking about because you feel everything I just said. You feel like a one-eyed pug dog. I want you to understand something. Your Father in heaven values you more than you know and cannot wait for you to come home and is waiting. All of heaven is waiting to have a party, and it's going to get crazy when you decide to come home because you are so missed by God. And keep your eyes open because he's been sending people your direction to get you out of the mess you're in. Keep your eyes open. But for the rest of us, I want to just make sure we all know, why are you here? Northview, why are you here? Because God loves his children who are not yet a part of Northview as much as he loves those who are a part of Northview. And he's left you here so you can bring them home. Don't ever forget why you are. Why don't you stand up? I'm going to close in prayer and we will be done. Thank you for the privilege of speaking with you and being here. You guys are fantastic. Let me pray. So, Father, thank you for this church. I pray for them. I pray that you continue to use them. God, I pray that they don't ever fall asleep in what's going on here. I pray that this never becomes second nature, that they never just say, this is just another day at another church. God, that they understand they have been uniquely placed here for significant kingdom purposes. God, use them for that. I pray for them in Jesus' name. Amen. Bless you guys. Thanks.